Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bosom Friends, The Intimate World of James Buchanan and William Rufus King, by Thomas J. Balcherski, narrated by Rick Adamson. Introduction. Remembering. In the aftermath of the Civil War, few wished to remember the politics of the prior generation. Perhaps few still wanted to reminisce about the vibrant social landscape of the nation's capital before the war. To many, such recollections must have recalled a tragic scene from a disastrous era in American history. Fittingly, a historian, Elizabeth Freeze Loomis Ellett, took up the challenge of placing the calamities of the war years into a broader story about social elites from days gone by. In her final works, Ellett turned to the more recent past, using the papers of prominent women to enliven the people, places, and events of high society. In reviewing the administration of President John Tyler, 1841 to 1845, she ascribed a peculiarly communal aspect. Members from the various sections of the Union, intending to domesticate with their families for a session, arranged what was styled a mess, Ellett noted, generally formed of persons professing the same politics, having an identity of interests, associations, feelings, etc. Ellett then cited the two most famous messmates from that period, the Democratic senators and long-life bachelors, James Buchanan of Pennsylvania, and William Rufus King of Alabama. Buchanan and King were called the Siamese twins, she asserted. They ate, drank, voted, and visited together. This intriguing characterization of James Buchanan and William Rufus King as the Siamese twins drew upon a phrase that had been evolving for 40 years in the American lexicon. It first appeared in 1829, when Scottish promoter Robert Hunter brought the conjoined twins, Chang and Eng Bunker, the twins from Siam, to the attention of the American public. During the 1830s, these original Siamese twins became a media sensation as they toured the United States and England. Soon thereafter, the phrase took on new, more literary qualities. English writer Edward Bulwer, titled an 1833 satirical poem, The Siamese Twins, while a cartoonist lampooned the unnatural alliance of Great Britain and the newly formed nation of Belgium as a conjoined pair. American journalists and cartoonists seized upon the designation in ways that were both more political and gendered. In 1837, for example, a reporter compared the governors of the neighboring states of Mississippi and Arkansas to the Siamese twins, as they both act and think alike. Of all the new meanings attributed to the Siamese twins, the political one spread widest and lasted longest. By the 1840s, politicians closely aligned in the public eye were likened, usually in a satirical or pejorative way, to Siamese twins. In the presidential election year of 1840, for example, a Whig cartoonist attacked the partisan and allegedly corrupt connection between Democratic newspaper editors Francis Preston Blair and Amos Kendall by depicting the men conjoined by an oversized ligature at their torsos. In response, a Democratic newspaper editorialized that the Whig presidential candidate William Henry Harrison was a political Siamese twin to his vice presidential running mate, John Tyler. Again in 1844, the duo of John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay warranted the same description. In the heat of the 1856 presidential election, when James Buchanan was a candidate, a pro-Democratic newspaper espoused the connection between the opposition Republican Party and Northern abolitionists to be like Eng and Chang. The death of one would kill the other. 8 years later, Republicans caricatured the Democratic presidential ticket of Civil War General George McClellan of New Jersey and George Pendleton of Ohio as a conjoined pair, bound by a farcical ligature on which read the words, "The party tie." Like these other metaphorical couplings, Ellet's pairing of Buchanan and King certainly warranted the nickname. Even so, this curious label prompts many questions. Who were these two men from the 19th century past? How and why did they enter politics? Why did neither one ever marry? And how unusual were they for not doing so? From there, questions about their mess relationship follow. What exactly was the nature of their domestic arrangement in Washington? Did it include a sexual element, or was it merely a platonic friendship? Did eating, drinking, and socializing together really translate to voting together on political issues? Since the phrase Siamese twins typically stemmed from a partisan critique, questions about their public persona ensue. What did their political opponents think of them, and what did they write about them in turn? And how did they manage to achieve their political successes in spite of it all? Finally, how did the historian, Elizabeth Ellet, come to remember them as the Siamese twins, and more to the point, how have they been remembered since? The older of the pair by 5 years, William Rufus Devane King, 1786 to 1853, was born on the eve of the U.S. Constitutional Convention and died as the nation's sitting vice president. After attending the University of North Carolina, he rapidly thrived in public life. Elected to the State House of Commons in 1808, he was chosen for the U.S. House of Representatives in 1811, one of the youngest men ever to serve in that body. A fierce war hawk during the War of 1812, he subsequently served abroad as secretary to the Foreign Legation in the Kingdom of Naples and then at St. Petersburg, Russia. Upon his return to America, King headed southwest as part of the Great Cotton Boom and settled near the new town of Selma, Alabama. Elected to the U.S. Senate in 1819, he served continuously until President Tyler appointed him American Minister to France in 1844. By the time of his first mess arrangement with Buchanan began a decade earlier, he was firmly established as both a confirmed bachelor and a Southern spokesman for national unity in the Democratic Party. By comparison, James Buchanan, 1791 to 1868, was born during the administration of President George Washington and died publicly discredited during his own post-presidential retreat to Wheatland, his country estate near Lancaster. In his education at Dickinson College, legal training, and early political engagements, he shared a trajectory similar to King's. As a Pennsylvania Federalist and state legislator, however, he opposed the War of 1812 and received the warm support of his Lancaster townsmen for the stance. His failed engagement to Anne Coleman ended tragically with her death in 1819, after which time he recommitted himself to a life in politics. Elected to the U.S. House of Representatives soon thereafter, he served 5 terms in that body. Next exiled to Russia by President Andrew Jackson, he returned triumphantly in 1833 with a successfully negotiated commercial treaty in hand. At the time of his election to the U.S. Senate in 1834, he was the leader of the Amalgamator wing of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party and a rising star on the national scene. Like King, he was a bachelor, though a far more reluctant one, and a northern voice for compromise and conciliation within the Democratic Party. The period of their active friendship, from their initial mess arrangement in December 1834 to King's death in April 1853, spanned more than 18 years. Within this timeline, their relationship contained 2 discrete phases. First, the period from December 1834 to May 1844, when they overlapped in the U.S. Senate and often lived together while in Washington, and second, the period from May 1844 to April 1853, when, with a few notable exceptions, the two men lived apart and operated independently. In its initial phase, their friendship centered around the institution of the Washington Boarding House, or Mess, where they ate and drank together in relative domestic harmony. They also attended social functions together, which often centered around still more eating and drinking. By thus intertwining their domestic fortunes while in Washington, they slowly but steadily forged an intimate personal friendship. In time, Buchanan and King intermingled members of their own families, notably their two nieces, Harriet Rebecca Lane and Catherine Margaret Ellis, into an extended network of affective kinship. During this more intimate phase of their friendship, they became one of the best-known and most successful examples of a domestic political partnership in American history. In many ways, the structure of congressional service in the early American Republic dictated the first phase of their friendship, 1834 to 1844. Even after Congress relocated from Philadelphia to the unfinished city of Washington, D.C. at the close of 1800, the average congressman spent surprisingly little time in the Capitol. Congressional sessions, divided into two-year spans to match the length of terms for members of the House of Representatives, followed an unusually long cycle from election to service. Many representatives were selected fully a year or more before the start of their terms of office, a situation that did not change officially until 1875. In the case of William Rufus King, for example, he was elected to his seat in the fall of 1810, but did not arrive in Washington as a member of the 12th U.S. Congress until November 1811. From there, the first session of the new Congress most typically lasted until the late spring or early summer months, after which the body recessed until fall. This pattern persisted well into the 1930s. Only then did most congressmen return home, where, as it turns out, the majority had consciously chosen to live apart from their wives and families while in Washington. Several factors compounded the decision of most congressmen to separate from loved ones. For one, the great difficulty and slow rate of travel in the era, before widespread railroad connections, made a trip to Washington an uncertain proposition. At the start of his congressional career, for example, King endured a 4 to 5 day journey from North Carolina to Washington, while Buchanan's trip from Lancaster took the better part of 2 days, with stops in Philadelphia and Baltimore. For another, most lawmakers were not compensated sufficiently to cover the expenses of maintaining both a residence in Washington and another back home. Until 1816, representatives were paid a per diem rate of $6, unchanged since the first Congress in 1789, after which a salary of $1,500 was set. However, this new allotment proved wildly controversial, and the subsequent Congress was forced to return to the per diem rate system with a twist. Representatives and senators were granted an $8 per diem and another $8 per 20 miles traveled to Washington. The convoluted pay scheme lasted until 1855, with one result being that even congressional sessions without much business lasted the full time allotted. If the paltry salary were not enough to turn away elected officials from serving multiple terms, many congressional districts practiced a strict system of rotation in office, called a yearling policy by one historian, such that turnover in office was comparatively much higher in the early 19th century than it is today. On top of that, many congressmen withdrew early from their terms in office, often motivated by entirely personal factors. Washington could be a lonely place. The living conditions of early Washington also drove the parameters of social life in the Capitol, and thus the early years of the friendship of Buchanan and King. Far from the modern city that it later became, the Capitol in these years was very much a work in progress. The roads were muddy, and the surrounding landscape dotted with swamps. Even if a congressman could afford to bring his family to Washington, accommodations were often communal and cramped. Few politicians, save members of the cabinet, ever owned their own homes. To solve the problem of housing, congressmen lived together in boarding houses, which were called by the name mess. From the earliest congresses of the 1790s until after the Civil War, these boarding houses most commonly accommodated congressmen while in Washington. For the reasonable rate of around $10 a week, individuals could obtain single rooms within a shared house that might contain as many as a dozen other bedrooms, each often furnished with little more than a bed, dresser, and nightstand. In the era before indoor plumbing, the boarders relied on domestic servants, often enslaved African Americans, to meet the everyday needs of ablution. Although boarding houses existed in every American city during these years, the Washington boarding house differed in that its inhabitants were the country's leading elected officials. There was an essential communal element to boarding house life in the capital. Dinner, the most important of the meals, was served between 3 and 6 o'clock, with a menu that featured an assortment of meats, fish, berries, and pies. Alcoholic beverages such as wine, brandy, and Madeira often accompanied meals, though congressmen provided these items at their own expense. The messmates regularly congregated in the shared parlors, especially around the fireplaces in the colder months, where they smoked cigars and discussed politics and the social doings of the capital. Since many boarding houses featured the mixed company of men and women, such gatherings could be quite formal. From these parlors, calls were made and returned around the Capitol Hill neighborhood, such that congressional messes functioned as social centers in the early republic. Congressmen frequently entertained their fellow politicians with food and drink, just as they might have hosted guests back home. And without access to formal offices, congressmen worked primarily from their desks in the chambers of the Capitol, boarding houses functioned as auxiliary office space as well. From these parlor politics, much important legislation germinated. On the one hand, the basis for the relationship of James Buchanan and William Rufus King was not particularly uncommon. Whether as cause or effect of their boarding house connection, Buchanan and King followed a remarkably similar political course as congressional messmates. As Elizabeth Ellet noted, they almost always voted in common with one another. Stalwart Jacksonians, they offered unwavering support for the Democratic agenda, including the independent sub-treasury system, a compromise tariff, and the expansion of federal land holdings. But each man counseled careful moderation on sectional issues. For his part, King consistently balanced the interests of the slaveholding South with those of the National Democratic Party. However, his political partnership with the patriotic Buchanan required that he prioritize the permanent continuation of the Union. In turn, Buchanan joined King in combating abolitionism. He even devised a key aspect of the Senate's infamous gag rule that forbade the reception of anti-slavery petitions. Along with their Democratic messmates, Buchanan and King constituted a powerful voting bloc in the Jacksonian era. By the end of their shared mess, they agreed implicitly that the principles of their increasingly conservative creed offered the best way to preserve the national union. On the other hand, their nearly 10-year boarding house relationship appears quite unusual in retrospect. After all, the two men originally hailed from very different parts of the country, King from the South, Buchanan from the Mid-Atlantic. From varying socioeconomic statuses, King a scion of wealthy slaveholding planters, Buchanan the son of a yeoman shopkeeper on the western frontier, and opposite political parties, King an adherent to the Democratic-Republican Party, Buchanan a devoted Federalist. They nevertheless shared a few essential personal factors in common. Being descendants of Scots-Irish immigrants, both men shared similar ethno-cultural origins. They also attended college in an age where higher education was a luxury. Most critically, neither man married. In their capacities as lifelong bachelors, they forged an enduring political partnership that withstood the many challenges of their public lives. In the second phase of their relationship, 1844 to 1853, separated by distance, their friendship lost something of its earlier personal intimacy and devolved into a more overtly political alliance. While King served as American minister to France, Buchanan transitioned from the Senate to the cabinet as Secretary of State under President James Knox Polk. Thus separated, the inherent weaknesses of their friendship forged by domestic propinquity, witnessed in the scattered nature of their correspondence and the widening gulf between their romantic pursuits, became painfully evident. Even as King's counsel proved personally beneficial to Buchanan at critical moments, they drifted apart politically, especially over foreign policy questions. Under the expansionist Polk, Buchanan promoted territorial conquest from Mexico to Cuba for the benefit of southern slaveholders. Ironically, King advised against the acquisition of these same lands. In their final years, they approached political questions at cross purposes. During the congressional debates of 1850, Buchanan attempted to remain above the political fray, while King actively worked for a lasting compromise. Even so, glimpses of their old domestic intimacy resurfaced, as Buchanan occasionally visited with King in Washington. But these later life efforts proved fleeting. In the end, the alienating effects of distance and time, compounded by a subtle divergence in their political views, had reduced the former intimacy of their friendship. Nevertheless, the symbolic meaning of their political union soared to new heights in its final years. During the second phase of their friendship, each man reached and nearly obtained together the nomination of the Democratic Party for the vice presidency, King, and presidency, Buchanan. In the presidential cycles of 1844, 1848, and finally 1852, they worked tirelessly for a combined Buchanan-King ticket. But each time, the political tides turned against a bachelor ticket in favor of other combinations. All the same, their brand of political conservatism appealed to their fellow partisans as a safe choice in the face of ever-mounting sectionalism. In 1852, the Democratic Party selected King as its vice presidential nominee to run alongside Franklin Pierce of New Hampshire, while it chose Buchanan as its presidential candidate in 1856. Like the other pairs of political Siamese twins of the era, each man had proved integral to the success of the other. Yet, conjoined as they were, their individual identities had been merged before the councils of the National Democratic Party. In consequence, only one of the two men seemed capable of political advancement at a time. The active lifespan of these Siamese twins thus spanned from the partisan years of the Jacksonian era to the more sectional ones of the late antebellum period. During those same 18 years, the United States expanded from a nation circumscribed by rivers for its western border to one bounded by oceans, grew its population, both free and enslaved, at unprecedented rates, and finally deadlocked its politics over the divisive issue of slavery. Indeed, at the heart of the friendship of Buchanan and King lay a solemn pact, developed in the boarding houses of Jacksonian Washington, that the Union must not split over the question of slavery. As a politically conservative Northerner, Buchanan acquiesced to protect Southern interests at almost any price, while as a politically moderate Southerner, King stemmed the tide of radical sectionalism in favor of compromise. As such, they comprised a cross-sectional conservative force in American politics for nearly a generation. Theirs was an interwoven, intertwined, and finally interdependent union that worked primarily to better one another, the Democratic Party, and by extension, the nation as they conceived it. This book tells their story. The duo of Buchanan and King received much criticism, often rendered in the form of gossip from their opponents. This gossip can be understood as gendered language in the grammar of political combat. For some adversaries, character attacks allowed for the easy dismissal of political rivals, such as when Andrew Jackson supposedly called King by the name Miss Nancy in the 1830s, or when John Quincy Adams recorded in his diary that King was a gentle slave monger in 1844. For others, colorful insults levied against opponents endeared them to their correspondents, such as when Aaron Brown of Tennessee variously ridiculed King as Aunt Nancy, Miss Fancy, and Buchanan's wife in an 1844 letter to Sarah Childress Polk, wife of the future president. In turn, King and Buchanan gossiped among themselves and with various female family members and friends in the refined diction of highly educated men. In so doing, they established their own grammar of manhood, in which the exigencies of a political agenda intersected with the private realm of thought and feeling. Gossip thus circulated across the private correspondence of multiple circles of male and female political actors. While their political adversaries could only speculate about the relationship of Buchanan and King, the scholarship of subsequent generations has uncovered far more evidence about the pair. In the 1880s, George Ticknor Curtis published the first major biography of James Buchanan, which included a now infamous letter from Buchanan to Mrs. Cornelia Roosevelt, dated May 13, 1844. "I am now solitary and alone, having no companion in the house with me," he complained, following King's departure from Washington. "I have gone a-wooing to several gentlemen, but have not succeeded with any one of them," he reported, before adding, "I feel that it is not good for man to be alone, and should not be astonished to find myself married to some old maid who can nurse me when I am sick, provide good dinners for me when I am well, and not expect from me any very ardent or romantic affection." In the early 1900s, John Bassett Moore, editor of the largest collection of Buchanan letters and papers, reprinted this letter and several others from the Buchanan-King correspondence, though he offered little context for them. This new evidence notwithstanding, neither Curtis nor Moore replicated the characterization of Buchanan and King as Siamese twins. Matters began to change with the next generation of Buchanan biographers. In an article from 1938, biographer Philip Auchinpaw, likely drawing on the reference provided by Elizabeth Ellett, included a footnote that described King as Buchanan's Siamese twin, United States Senator for Alabama. In 1962, Philip Klein published the definitive biography of Buchanan. About Buchanan's relationship with King, however, Klein largely repeated the charter of previous generations. Washington had begun to refer to King and Buchanan as the Siamese twins. While Buchanan's major biographers quietly elided this gossip, the Polk biographer Charles Sellers expanded upon it. "King's conspicuous intimacy with the bachelor Buchanan," he wrote in 1966, "gave rise to some cruel jibes around Washington." Sellers then repeated the salient gossip of Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams, and Aaron Brown, and in a footnote excerpted King's reply to Buchanan's May 1844 letter. "I am selfish enough to hope you will not be able to procure an associate who will cause you to feel no regret at our separation. For myself, I shall feel lonely in the midst of Paris, for there I shall have no friends with whom I can commune as with my own thoughts." The pieces of a new interpretation were gradually falling into place. Nevertheless, the intimate nature of male friendships little concerned the narratives constructed by older forms of political history. Indeed, the relationship of Buchanan and King may well have remained a footnote to American history, had it not been for a new interest in the study of historical gender and sexuality, especially same-sex sexuality, in the past several decades. In turn, the popular view of Buchanan's various intimate attachments, and especially his relationship with King, began to change radically beginning in the 1980s. Tabloid journalism played a
sample complete. Ready to continue?